You know how there's some things that are just so good, you just don't know how to enjoy them quickly enough, how to really savor the moment. Well, this is how I felt about my conversation with my guest today on the Queso Podcast. Leslie Honoré, a poet from Chicago, joins me today as we talked about everything from domestic violence to discussions on race and division. I even got a history lesson. Man, I felt like I was sitting at the feet of a master, because really I am. I came to know Leslie as I first ran across one of her poems, Backpacks. And I was enthralled since then, been following her since then. And I'm honored to have been able to contact her through a live that she was doing on Facebook. And I was able to contact her and she accepted to come on my show. So I am so excited to present Leslie Honoré. Thank you so much for joining me. Make sure to follow Leslie Honoré on Facebook and Instagram, where she identifies herself as a Blaxican mommy poet, freedom fighter writer, California born, NOLA cultivated, and polished in the shy. Make sure to also follow Latinos Progresando and look for the YouTube video where Leslie Honoré took place in Mex Talks. Thanks for joining me.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you for asking.
I'm so thrilled. I was so thrilled when you even saw my message on the live. I was like so excited. I was thinking about you since I started the podcast. And I don't know you, but I know you now. I will know you more. It started when I read your poem, Backpacks. That's how it started for me. And then I just followed you, and I've just been there.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. So why don't we start by you telling us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your background.
Absolutely. Well, I was born. No, just kidding. Go all the way back to the beginning. So I grew up in Los Angeles. My mom is a Mexican immigrant. She immigrated when she was 15 from Sinaloa. My dad is from New Orleans. He was African American, and they met in Los Angeles. So grew up in LA, went to a historically Black university in New Orleans, Xavier University of Louisiana. And then after graduation, moved to Indianapolis for a year and absolutely hated it. Sorry, Indiana people, it was miserable. And I come to Chicago on the weekends to do poetry, and ended up moving to Chicago, doing poetry here. I'm getting married, having kids. Unfortunately, my husband was abusive. And so that marriage ended after about 11 years. But pretty much during the marriage, I stopped writing. I really focused on the kids. And as anyone who is a survivor of domestic abuse knows, that those type of relationships don't start off negatively. It's a slow happening until you get to a place where you don't know how you got there and how you missed the red flags. And so there's a lot of shame associated with it. That's why I like to talk about it, because I think I want people to dispel the stereotypes that they think of who are women who have suffered and who are survivors, and that they can look like anybody, educated, uneducated, your friend, not your friend. But after my ex-husband left is when I started to really write again. I've always, my whole life is something I've always done. Elementary school, high school, in college, I was editor of our literary journal. I did open mics then. Writing was always a part of me. Mm-hmm. It was just during the marriage, it was so difficult to find a way to tap into that it really wasn't until after he left that I was able to allow myself that space again. And then I give a ton of credit to social media. I mean, say what you want to say about Mark Zuckerberg, but I owe my career to a social media platform. So maybe about maybe 5 years ago, it's coming on 5 years here in Chicago, we had a 9-year-old named Tyshawn Lee who was murdered. And I kind of just wrote a free verse poem and I put it on Facebook. And one of my girlfriends said, you know, you should share this. You should make this public for other people to see. And I was like, nobody wants to read. Nobody's reading poetry on social media. And she was like, no, share it, you know, make it public. And I did. And it got like 13,000 shares. And it was my first time my poem, like I had any attention like that on social media. And I kept with it. And I just found what I feel like is both my groove for creativity and my purpose is to really be able to communicate succinctly experiences of Black and Brown people in America that gives us voice when we're so often unheard or silenced or seen as invisible, and brings our humanity in spaces that people sometimes, you know, see it differently when it's presented differently. I've had so many white people reach out, like after Backpacks, saying, I had no idea that this was how a Black mother felt. So just to give a different perspective. And I try to write with some immediacy within like 24 hours of something happening. I try to write something and put it out. And then in the summer of 2016 through 2017 is when I did the Kickstarter for my book and launched my book. And I've just been writing and connecting ever since. I've been extremely lucky to find an audience that feels like friends and extended family, that we talk, we communicate, we meet, that it's not something that's just a blank slate where I'm putting out and someone's receiving. They give back to me. And it's a wonderful exchange. And I feel so honored to be able to share my purpose and my talent with other people who have expressed that they need it and appreciate it. So just feel extremely humble and grateful.
Yeah, and I thank you, first of all, for sharing that personal experience about your marriage. And I have been there myself, so I know it takes a lot to get out. It's really easy to judge from the outside, mm-hmm. as far as like just leave and all that. But writing as well has been my outlet. And it's true, once you get rid of those shackles, it seems like it just flows after that. And that's, you know, another thing about your writing that I really enjoy is that free verse that's so easy. It seems so easy for you. It seems to, you know, it's so obvious that it comes from your heart, the way that you write. And I really feel that's what makes people connect with you, because we're all feeling this, but we don't know how to put it into words. And then we look in social media and there it is, exactly what we wanted to even, you know, can't even form the words to say it, but somehow you make it happen. It flourishes for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, you know, I think it's really unique. Like you said, your mom being from Mexico and your mm-hmm. dad being African American, what are the experiences that you have been going through right now in this? You know, there's been so much going on, especially in Chicago. We saw a lot of, I guess you could say, both communities having different opinions.
Yeah. I think it's always been my experience of, you know, having a foot in both worlds, and for a long time, never feeling Mexican enough, not feeling Black enough, and really spending, you know, a great part of my life reconciling what it meant to be both. And what it, you know, that I can be proud of both, and that how I define myself is how I define myself, and it doesn't have to come with someone else's opinions. I think now, being in my late 40s, we have so many great ways to identify. You know, the term Afro-Latina was not around when I was growing up. Yeah. You know, there wasn't even an option in the census into the late 90s for biracial or multiracial. So I grew up having to do a lot of explanation, you know, a lot of what are yous, you know, what are you? And then, you know, that just feeling very intrusive, and you know, I'm like, I'm a person. And then, you know, people going, oh, you're Puerto Rican, and I'm like, no, you know, I'm Mexican and proud of it, and I'm also Black and proud of it. Recently here in Chicago, though, I think what we have seen is a lot of airing of our dirty laundry. I think as a first generation immigrant, that one of the first things immigrants are taught to do, regardless if they come from a Latin American country or Eastern European country or even an African country, they're taught Black hate. They're taught through the media. They are taught through, you know, how our country is designed to hate Black people, to think of Black people as less than. And then what America really tries to indoctrinate well is immigrant hate. So I think Black people, you know, often feel that immigrants are trying to take away something from them that they have very little of. You know, people often say, James Baldwin, who said, to be Black, to be a Black American, is to be American without privilege and African without that heritage, without a lineage of language and culture and religion. And so very often we are pitted against each other in ways that destroy the power that we have when we're unified. And as Black and brown people, our oppression, you know, it may be different fingers, but they're all in the same hand. It may look differently, you know. So in Latinx communities, you know, it looks like gentrification. It looks like, you know, ICE raids. In Black communities, it looks like displacement. It looks like lack of resources. It looks like systemic racism. The fact is that they all come from white supremacy. They're all coming from the same place.
Yeah.
And the powers have been very intentional with making sure that we don't have opportunities to be unified, because there's power in that. So I've heard ugly from both sides. You know, if someone doesn't know I'm Mexican and I'm in a Black circle, I've heard things that I've had to, you know, educate on, and vice versa. I think I would challenge, you know, anyone who is Latinx to say that they haven't heard the conversations at the table, you know, ese negro, ese negra, you know, all of our tios and tias and our abuelos, everybody has some form of identifying Black people as other in Latin community.
It's shameful, because even within our own community, Mexican community, or even Puerto Rican community, there's division between light and dark, even if you're 100% Mexican. But if you're from the costa, costeña, you know, they want to show the difference. Or if you have a baby and they say, oh, tiene ojos claros, it's so beautiful. Why is it more beautiful to have a baby with blue eyes than, you know, brown eyes? And that's one of the things that I have emphasized with my girls. I have three daughters, always emphasizing the beauty of their brown eyes. You know, your beautiful chocolate drop eyes or your cinnamon eyes, and really trying to ingrain that in them, that is beautiful. What you are, what you have is beautiful. Like you said, not the other. It's always about the other.
I think what both of our communities experience is a legacy of colonization.
Yes.
So colorism in the Black community and in the Latinx community, you know, the closer you are to the colonizer, the more accepted you are. You know, in Mexicans, the less, you know, indigenous you look, the better you are. I mean, if we look at our TV stations, if we look at Univision, if we look at our novelas, there are very few women who look like you and I on there. And there are even less women who represent the African diaspora in Latin communities. So my oldest daughter, who's 20, she says, you know, why is Latinidad always Selena and never Celia? And that's very true. How we represent ourselves and how we've been represented is a very narrow scope of what it means, because there are Black Mexicans, you know, there are Black Puerto Ricans and Black Cubans and Black people from Panama. I mean, The Black experience has touched the world, and to deny it is to deny parts of ourselves, and it is to be in alignment with the colonizer, who, you know, has been telling us for far too long what is beautiful, what is important, what makes value. So challenging that, I try to challenge that in my work and how I live. But sometimes it's difficult to break those shackles in our own families, because it requires us to be brave and to call it out when we see it.
Yes, there's a level of courage when talking to those folks in your family who are so just so used to it. They don't even see it as being wrong. And the funny story about the Queso podcast, or you might have noticed it's in parentheses, queso. It all started for me just a play on words that I was doing, because I had seen a lot of my friends on social media. I'm from South Texas. I grew up right on the border. Like I like to say, with one chancla on this side and the other chancla on the other side. Mm-hmm. And growing up in that, you know, deep South Texas, there's a real division, believe it or not, between people who want to identify with being Mexican or being a U.S. citizen. Mm. Oh, I live on the border, but that doesn't mean I'm here illegally. Even though my last name might be Orozco, you know, some people might say, well, I'm Amelia Orozco. And because I want to blend in and I don't want to call attention to myself as being different or not being part of this community on this side. So I started to see a lot of those things on social media with some of my friends back home, and even had like a little discussion with someone about, he said, well, I never felt the difference. I never felt, you know, what you're talking about. And I thought, well, maybe I had a different experience with my teachers, you know, that everyone had a different point of view, or it was just so used to it that you didn't realize it was happening. And so that's just a little play on words, and came up with the queso. And I was like, okay, well, for some people it's the queso, and that's okay. If that's what you choose to do, that's fine too. But I just find it interesting. It's a way for me to remember. A lot of times we are forced to, as you said, in being colonized, to adjust ourselves to this environment, whether it be how we pronounce a word, if you're just learning English. So I think it's okay if someone struggles to say my name. Like, it's okay. You know, someone else can struggle now and say, you know, Orozco, or just try to pronounce that better, because we're expected to do it as well.
Yep.
So that's just a little history on that.
Thank you for sharing that.
So, you know, going back to your backpack story, it's so funny because at the time I ran into your poem. I know it probably had been floating around for a while, but I was actually reading the book, The Hate You Give, at the time that you wrote that I found your poem. And I just thought, oh, wow, you know, this is just fate, like finding this poem. And it really brought tears to my eyes, because I just, you know, it's such a scary time that we're living in, or maybe it's always been this way, and you can tell me more about that. We're just now being more aware of it.
Yeah. I think the Black community would say it's always been like this. And what we are seeing now is an immediacy on how we report and tell and share the stories. I think cell phones with cameras were a game changer. But you know, even before that, we were recording police brutality. We can look back to Rodney King. So we had, you know, video of that. And I was in LA when Rodney King happened, and was in LA for those riots. I think a sophomore in high school.
Wow.
So it's nothing new. You know, it is just that we are seeing it, you know, with less lag time, with immediacy, that we have a little bit more control on the narrative. And what we see is, even when we have video, you know, even when it's documented, that people are still not held accountable. And that is because the system was not designed to protect Black and brown people. It was, you know, this country was created for and by straight white Christian men. And that's who it was created for. It wasn't created with us in mind. The Black poet Audre Lorde has a wonderful quote that says, the tools of master's house will never be used to dismantle it. I just totally butchered that quote. It's not right. But basically, you know, what was created, how they created this country and the laws, can't be used to to take it apart, we have to dismantle it all. Like the laws are against us. The police are against us. Like the systems and the policies are created to keep us in places where we are fighting for the smallest amount of resources on every battlefront, whether it be in Black communities or in brown communities. When we talk about immigration, if you are an Eastern European white person, it is much easier to immigrate legally to this country than any other position. Right. So it's going to take a ton of work, but we have to call it out. And I think that's what we're trying to do. And I think we're finally getting to the point where more people are recognizing that we're not exaggerating when we're saying this is happening, that these aren't isolated incidents, that this is how our policing system is created. And it's created with bias, and it's biased toward people who look like us and our daughters and our sons.
I find it really interesting that our communities are judged by, you know, whites based on what it might look like, whether it's, you know, blight. I lived in Detroit for over 15 years before coming to Chicago. My parents live right off of Michigan Avenue near downtown. And I recall going to work downtown, passing near my parents' house, and seeing white gentlemen, nice car, probably from the suburbs, picking up a prostitute before going to the office. A prostitute that is hooked on crack, a prostitute who probably doesn't have anywhere to live, then, you know, dropping her off and heading into work to the office. After work, probably going home to the nice suburbs. And yet those are the people that we're complaining about our city, you know, having crack and having abandoned homes and prostitution. You know, they were the clients. They were the clients coming into our city and not helping, but yet they're the mouthpiece that talks against what's going on in these cities. And I find that really interesting because that never comes out in the long
term. We can talk all day. Like the two things that are happening in Chicago and Black and brown communities are both directly related to white flight and then a desire of white people to come back into the city, and are directly related to capitalism.
Right.
So whereas Blacks have been historically prohibited and, you know, as much red tape put in front of us to buying our communities, to getting loans, etc., we've had a difficult time with that purposefully. It really started after World War II when the GIs came back and the GI bills that were supposed to go to every soldier who fought in the war. And you were given a GI Bill to buy a house at a nominal rate. It expressly said, not for Negro soldiers.
Oh, wow.
So white people were able to come. And then the property they bought, there were clauses in their contracts that says, and you can't sell to a Negro. So what white people were able to do, and that's how suburbia started, is that they were able to buy homes and start generational wealth. So they were able to buy homes, take out loans, put their kids through college, and their kids were able to go to good schools and start generationally being able to build that. And Black people were not. And then subjugated to only being able to buy in redlining districts that, you know, had poor resources. In Latinx communities were a little bit different because in an immigrant family, we come with generations.
Right.
Didn't experience slavery where there was an intentional separation of family. There's power in having your grandmother and your great-grandmother and your uncles and your aunts with you. And we do that. We come as a family. We occupy one space. Mm-hmm. If, you know, one person works at one job, as many of your primos and primas are coming too. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to acquire wealth in a different way. But it still wasn't in the way that was successful to whites. So it may look like a lot of small mom and pop stores where it became very insular. Like, so we look at a community like Pilsen, mm-hmm. you know, for decades, that's where we lived because that's where we could live. That's our businesses that we created to support us, to make sure we had the things that we needed. And it, we created a beautiful, vibrant neighborhood.
And the housing was affordable at that time.
And housing was affordable. So what's happening now is that for the past, you know, 20 plus years, Black communities have been divested in Chicago, which means they have not been resourced. They have not, you know, we have food deserts where there are no grocery stores. Transit has not been plentiful and is not safe, does not have the same number of cars and running buses and trains that the North Side does. And so what happens there is that it's an intentional depreciation of property, which then allows people to come in and buy and price people out. Yeah. So what we have in Black communities is a displacement of people who have been longtime renters because they haven't been able to buy property, displacement of shop owners who can't afford the new rents, as these neighborhoods that are closer to downtown, which were once considered undesirable and now are, you know, hip and happening, right. We have people being displaced. Then in Latinx communities, we have gentrification happening. So we've worked very hard to make our communities vibrant and beautiful and full of all of our culture and things that people want to come and see. And now people want that. Right. And so they have the money to come and buy us out and to buy out the buildings where we have our storefronts and buy out buildings where we have our homes and build new homes in our community that we can't even afford. I think about the houses that are going up in Logan Square that are like $900,000. No one in that community can buy that home. But they are coming from the same place of white supremacy. Right. They just look different in our communities. So they have different solutions, but they're coming from the same place. And so I think that's what makes me the most mad about when we don't see each other. Cause all I see is so many similarities.
So many.
All I see is how we are alike and how keeping us divided, allows us to be powerless.
Right. And that's, I think that's the master plan, right? Like to divide mm-hmm. us because you divide and conquer. And, you know, speaking of having generational wealth, I think about the latest poem that you wrote about Chadwick Boseman, and the kind of wealth that I'm thinking about is just the wealth of culture and the example that he left and the way you were able to capture that. I noticed that someone also share your poem. I mean, it's really been gaining some following as well.
Yeah.
But I like to think of that, you know, wealth is also something that's not something you can hold in your hand. It's also something that we have, that our communities have, which is culture, which is flavor, which is, you know, I think you were talking about that on your live last week. It's like, I don't want to see someone sprinkling salt on their food like this. You know, I think our cultures have wealth. And like you said, that's what attracts people to our communities. Mm-hmm. What kinds of things do you see that we can contribute going forward as well? Like,
it's what we've always contributed. Everything, you know, people love about America is, you know, not to be, you know, in any way white bashing, I'm sure I'll get accused of it, but it's created by someone who is not white. It's created either by an immigrant or generations that were enslaved. The foods that we like, the music that we like, the shows that we like, our culture, you know, we've done nothing but make it better. Right. Like, can we imagine a Texas without Tex-Mex food?
Right, no.
No, can we imagine America without music contributions from Black people, right. Without jazz,
right.
You know, Motown. Without the blues, without Motown, without hip hop. I mean, you can hardly turn on the TV and not hear a commercial that has hip hop in it.
Right.
You know, everything that makes us uniquely American, you know, that people love the flavor of it, you know, has come from, you know, a culture that is widely disrespected by, you know, the current administration and people who agree with his beliefs.
And I was just going to get to that, how that administration has really contributed and condoned, I think, many of the atrocities that we've been seeing lately. And yes, mm-hmm. of course, like you said, these things have been happening, but I feel like now there's like a huge condoning, like there's a huge, like, yeah, go ahead, I'm behind you. You know, what just happened in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. That's been on the front burner now for a few days because this administration did not take the side of the victims, did not take the side of the protesters, made excuses for someone who literally has a huge weapon and is on the street shooting. I mean, how much more blatant can that get?
But so here's the thing, two things on that. This administration has definitely been more vocal and has worked very hard to end policies that were in place during the Obama administration to kind of undo some of what we had. But a lot of it is really what America is and does. They're just not doing the placating or the performative, you know, pretending that they care without actually have an action behind it. Mm. So these people have always been here. We've always worked for them, with them, gone to church with them. Our kids go to school with them and their families. They've always been here with the same thoughts, with the same backdoor policies when it came to who they hired, who they dated, who they wanted their kids around. None of it is new, but what this administration has allowed is it's given them a freedom to express it without fear of retribution.
That's what it is. Yeah, no fear on that end.
There's none because there's been no consequences. Like it blows my mind that there has not been some sort of coup or there hasn't been more done. We still have kids in cages. You know,
right.
And those are the ones that aren't a part of, you know, the almost 2,000 that have been lost, that we don't know where they are.
Right.
We don't know if they are dead or alive. Have they been sex trafficked? Have they been adopted? Where are they? That's still happening. Like, that's still going on while all the rest of this is still going on. There's still not water in Flint, Michigan. You know, these are things that are happening to Black and brown people,
right,
that are constant at this point. And we are not storming the White House, you know. But what it tells me is it's because more people than we realize or that we want to realize are okay with that.
And that's the ugly side of it, where we didn't really, I mean, I guess a lot of people have surprised me. Like, people that didn't think had those views, they actually have surprised me more than I thought. I thought, okay, maybe some people think that way, but more than I even thought are on that, you know, on that platform right now. But that's why it's important to get out and vote. I mean, we don't have the greatest choices, in my opinion. But
I agree, but we're going to vote for what we... There is no choice right now.
We're in a chess game, and we're gonna do what best will advance us forward with what we're given at this
exactly.
moment. Right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's interesting times we're living in, and the best person to talk to in times like this is a poet, I think.
Thank you.
'Cause you can get us there emotionally.
I try.
I think you do a very fine job. Anything you're working on right now, on any new topics?
No new topics right now. I have some speaking engagements lined up on the 17th, and it's a free event with Latinos Progresando here in Chicago. It's their annual MEX Talks. Okay. And myself and another poet are opening up the talks. And so I'm excited about that. And just working on my second book. So we're just editing and trying to get it perfect and hopefully to have it out, you know, by late fall in time for the holiday season. So it's constantly happening, and I'm grateful for that.
That's great. Now, the event in September, is that an in-person event?
No, it's not. It's online, so okay. It's through Zoom. So if you go to Latinos Progresando, their website, you'll be able to find the link for it. So it's available for That's whoever awesome. Wants to register and come see. Yeah.
I feel like I can go to so many events now.
it's you know, it's a weird thing. Like, I would much rather them be in person. But it's kind of opened the world up to, you know, how we attend and exchange information, and we can do it, you know, at home in our pyjamas in our chanclas, yes. And we don't have to get
tested. Yeah, just double check to make sure it is at home. No, I'm just kidding.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Now, your next book, the title of it is, I know I saw it on your website.
Yeah, it's Letters in Lagniappe. Lagniappe is a French word, and it's often used in New Orleans to mean a little something extra. So it's just a way to say, you know, it's a little Lagniappe.
And that's your dad's heritage, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's really nice. I know I saw how you honored your father's memory. I think that's beautiful. And I think your book will probably give us so much more on that. Is there anything you want to read for us before you go?
Oh my goodness. Is there anything I want to read? Is there anything you'd like me to read?
You know, I guess I'm fangirling, but I really love Backpacks. Would you read that one?
I will read Backpacks. I will grab a book so I can read it.
Awesome.
Because I'm on my phone right now.
That is so good.
And I can't read it off my phone. But I will absolutely read Backpacks.
Yeah, I had to really read and reread that. I really felt it. And I think that it's such, you know, poetry is such a way to open the door for so many people to continue reading on the topic. It's a good way to start someone on reading on any topic, really. But I think I love your topics. I think they're very direct, straightforward. And like I said, it just speaks to the heart. So
thank you. I appreciate that so much. And thank you so much for this opportunity. And I will read Backpacks for you.
And this is Leslie Honoré.
Leslie, don't forget my accent, though.
Oh, Leslie. Okay, let's see. If she spoke Spanish, how would she say Leslie? Leslie? Leslie Honoré.
Yep.
With Backpacks.
Thank you. When Black boys are born, we mothers kiss their faces, twirl our fingers in their curls, put them in carriers on our chest, show them to the world, our tiny Black princes. And when they start school as early as 3, we mothers place huge backpacks on their backs, and we slowly fill them with bricks, etched with tools, tattooed with truths, hoping to save them. Don't talk back. Don't get angry. Say yes, ma'am. Say no, sir. Don't fight, even if they hit you first, especially if they are white. Do your best, better than best. Be still, work hardest, brick. They get a little older and we add more. Keep your hands out of your pockets. Don't look them in the eye. Don't challenge. Don't put your manhood before your life. Just get home safe. Don't walk alone. Don't walk with too many boys. Don't walk towards police. Don't walk away from police. Don't buy candy or iced tea. Don't put your hood up. I'll drive you. I'll pick you up. You can't be free. Don't go wandering. Come home to me. Brick. They get a little older and we add more. Understand you are a threat, standing still, breathing. Your degrees are not your shield. Your job is not your shield. Your salary makes you a target. Your car makes you a target. Your nice house in a nice neighborhood makes you a target. Don't put your ego before your safety. Don't talk back. Don't look them in the eye. Get home to your wife, your son, brick. They weigh them down, this knowing of having to carry the load of their Blackness. The world hasn't changed. The straps just dig deeper into their skin. Their backs ache, but their souls don't break, our beautiful Black men. So when you ask me, and when you say, all lives matter, I will simply ask, will your son die with the world on his back? Mine will.
Thank you so much. That is so touching. That is just so beautiful. I'm speechless. Just every time I hear that and I think, well, then you're not supposed to live. I mean, really, it's everything, just life being, you know, living life. Can't live life because of the color of your skin, because people are afraid or that people are judging. And I think that might be that generational wealth that this generation needs to pass down, where we can see that change, where that mm-hmm. will be the change. It's going to take a while. It's going to take lots of work. And, you know, it's going to take working together, brown and black communities together. But I think that's what we need to pass down.
Absolutely.
Continuing the conversations, continuing the sharing, the helping each other. I mean, just everything, being there, just being each other's allies, being each other's mm-hmm. brothers and sisters.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. Thank you
so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm just so thrilled. Keep up the good work. Keep it up. And
thank you.
Soon. I mean, we might bump into each other in Chicago soon.
I hope so. Thank you. So nice speaking with you tonight.
Take care. Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.